All right, settle in. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. It's always exciting to get a new stack of sources from you, our listener. And honestly, one of the coolest things about this show is just the sheer variety of topics you bring us. Sometimes they seem, well, wildly different, maybe even a little unexpected, like the material sitting on our desk today. We're about to take a deep plunge into two areas you probably don't spend a lot of time thinking about day to day. But when you start poking around, they reveal some truly surprising science. On one side, we're looking at surprisingly complex bodily functions that just happen, often without us giving them a second thought, things like burping and hiccups. And on the other, we're going to unravel the fundamental physics behind something as simple and ubiquitous as looking in a mirror. It's really about finding the hidden science in the everyday world, kind of drawing inspiration for that everyday wonders idea we saw mentioned in one of the sources.
That's right. The sources you've provided cover these distinct, fascinating areas. We'll explore the physiological and, you know, the behavioral sides of things like burping, hiccups, and this thing called aerophagia. And then, yeah, shift gears entirely to dig into the physics of reflection, specifically how it applies to mirrors, both the flat ones and the curved ones. Our mission is to unpack the key information and insights from each of these subjects for you.
Exactly. So lean back, get comfortable, and get ready to be well-informed on some topics you might not expect to find so intriguing. Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with what comes up, specifically burping. You know it as burping, maybe belching. Medically, it's eructation. Seems pretty straightforward, right? Just letting gas out through your mouth, usually with a sound.
And while the end result is simple, the sources make it really clear that the underlying mechanisms aren't quite so simple. There isn't just one type of burp. The material describes two distinct kinds.
Two types. Okay, tell me about the normal one first, like the everyday one.
Right. The one most people experience regularly is called gastric belching. This is your body's physiological reflex. The gas actually comes from the stomach. And it's released when the muscular valve at the bottom of your esophagus, the lower esophageal sphincter, relaxes just briefly. Doctors call this a transient lower esophageal sphincter relaxation.
TLESR. Okay, I've heard that term.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a good thing. It serves a purpose.
Absolutely. This gastric belching serves a crucial function. It decompresses your stomach. Think about all the air you swallow when you eat or drink. This reflex vents that air, preventing your stomach from getting overly distended, and importantly, stopping large volumes of swallowed air from moving into your intestines where they could cause more trouble, like bloating. It's an involuntary reflex, something your body just does automatically, perhaps 25 to 30 times a day, the sources suggest.
Okay, that makes sense. But then there's the second type.
Yes, supergastric belching. And this is fundamentally different. And the sources really highlight this distinction. The air expelled in this type, it doesn't actually originate from the stomach at all. Instead, the air is quickly swallowed or sort of sucked into the esophagus right before being expelled again.
Swallowed and then immediately pushed back out so that it doesn't even make it down to the stomach.
Exactly. And this is the key insight. Mm. Supergastric belching isn't a physiological reflex like the gastric kind. It's a behavior. The sources describe a couple of ways this happens. Sometimes it involves a quick contraction of the diaphragm creating negative pressure that pulls air in when the upper sphincter relaxes. Or sometimes people use their tongue and throat muscles to kind of push air in. Then abdominal muscles quickly push it back out. A really telltale sign mentioned is that this type of belching never happens when someone is asleep.
Ah, which really reinforces that it's a conscious or maybe semi-conscious behavior, not an automatic reflex.
Precisely.
Wow, that distinction is huge. Because the sources point out that the problem of excessive belching, and we're talking like maybe 10 or even 20 times a minute for some people, is often the supergastric type. And if the problem isn't too much gas production in the stomach, but a learned behavior of swallowing and expelling air, well, then the treatment approach has to be completely different, right?
Exactly right. And this is where the challenge often lies for patients and doctors. They feel like they have an overwhelming amount of gas. It can be difficult for them to grasp that they aren't producing excess gas. They're actually swallowing excess air and then immediately expelling it. So the treatment shifts from addressing, say, gas in the stomach to addressing the behavior itself. The sources strongly support behavioral therapy, often involving speech therapists. They help patients understand the mechanism, become aware of when they're doing it, and learn techniques like glottis training and controlled breathing exercises to break that cycle.
That makes sense, like retraining a habit.
Pretty much. And while other approaches like maybe hypnosis or certain medications are mentioned, the evidence presented in these sources really leans heavily towards that behavioral intervention being the most effective.
It's amazing how just understanding the mechanism completely changes the potential solution. The sources also connect belching to other common conditions like GERD.
Gastroesophageal reflux disease, yeah.
Right, GERD, and also functional dyspepsia.
Yes. That link is interesting. People with GER tend to have more frequent episodes of that lower esophageal sphincter relaxation, those TLSRs we mentioned, which means they often swallow air more frequently, leading to an increase in the normal gastric belches. And sometimes they can also develop this supergastric behavior on top of that.
Okay.
So treatments that reduce reflux, like acid suppressants or specific TLESR inhibitors, baclofen is mentioned in the sources, can also help reduce belching in those GERD patients. And similarly, functional dyspepsia is also associated with more frequent air swallowing and consequently more gastric belching.
And there's a really surprising consequence mentioned, especially after certain surgeries for reflux.
Oh yeah, this is one of those counterintuitive points from the sources. After anti-reflux surgery, like a Nissen fund application, where they create a wrap around the lower esophagus to stop reflux, well, that wrap can also make it difficult or even impossible for the stomach to vent gas through those normal gastric belches.
So the gas gets trapped.
Exactly. The consequence can be severe bloating and discomfort because the gas is just stuck in the stomach. And the sources describe how some patients, desperate for relief, might actually start exhibiting supergastric belching behavior, swallowing and expelling air just from the esophagus. But crucially, this doesn't actually vent the gas trapped way down in their stomach. It's a futile behavioral response trying to fix a physiological barrier.
Wow, a behavioral response that doesn't even solve the problem it's trying to fix.
That's a really powerful example of that distinction.
Yeah.
Okay, speaking of unexpected bodily responses, let's pivot slightly to hiccups. Medically, that's called syngultus, right? Right. Hiccups are those involuntary sudden contractions of your respiratory muscles. Often it's just one side of the diaphragm. That causes that sharp intake of breath against a closing glottis, leading to the characteristic hic sound.
And the sources make the point that, unlike something like sneezing or coughing, which clearly helps clear your airways, there's no widely agreed upon physiological advantage for the common hiccup, at least not in adults, it seems. Well, kind of pointless sometimes. Annoying, mostly.
That's exactly the mystery that one source dives into. It presents a really compelling hypothesis that hiccups might actually be an evolved reflex, and its primary purpose might have been to remove air bubbles from the stomachs of young, suckling mammals.
Wait, an ancient baby burping mechanism, but using hiccups instead. Tell me more about that hypothesis.
The idea is fascinating. So, an air bubble in a suckling infant's stomach could trigger specific sensory receptors. This would then activate the hiccup reflex arc, causing that sharp, sudden inhalation against the closed glottis. This action dramatically drops the pressure inside the chest cavity. This negative pressure would, in turn, literally sort of pull the air bubble up from the stomach into the mid-esophagus.
Where it could then be expelled more easily.
Precisely, allowing the infant to get rid of the air bubble and make room for more milk.
So it's like a sophisticated internal suction pump designed purely for efficient feeding in infants.
That's the idea. It makes a lot of sense in the context of infancy, where efficient feeding is paramount, and let's face it, air swallowing is pretty common when you're suckling. And the hypothesis is supported by the fact that hiccups are overwhelmingly most common and frequent in newborns and infants. They can spend up to like 2.5% of their time hiccuping.
Well, that much.
Yeah. And the frequency decreases significantly as we get older and switch to different feeding patterns and solid foods.
Okay, that definitely gives my occasional annoying hiccup a much grander evolutionary backstory. That's kind of cool. But the sources also bring us back to reality by noting that while most hiccups are just a minor annoyance, persistent
Lasting over 48 hours, yeah.
or intractable hiccups lasting over a month, those can signal something serious is going on.
This is a crucial point. When hiccups become persistent like that, they can be a symptom of an underlying disorder that's disrupting the complex network of nerves and brainstem circuits involved in the hiccup reflex itself. The sources list a whole range of potential causes, showing how widespread the issue can be. Neurological problems like strokes or brain lesions, infections, irritation of the nerves involved, like the vagus or phrenic nerves from things like tumors, or even medical devices like catheters or esophageal stents, gastrointestinal issues like severe GERD or pancreatitis, and even some heart conditions like angina pectoris. So if hiccups persist, a medical investigation is definitely warranted to find the root cause.
And how are these more serious persistent hiccups managed then? Is it just wait it out?
Well, for those short common bouts, the sources mention all the classic home remedies you've probably tried. holding your breath, swallowing a spoonful of sugar, gargling, stimulating the back of your throat. Even things like carotid massage are mentioned, though maybe leave that specific one to the doctors.
Good call.
For the persistent or intractable cases, treatment often focuses on managing the symptom, usually with medication. The sources note that chlorpromazine is technically the only drug specifically FDA approved for intractable hiccups, but others are frequently used with some success, including baclofen and gabapentin. And interestingly, even cannabis has been reported anecdotally in some cases. In very rare, severe, and unresponsive situations, treatments involving nerve blocks or even surgery on the phrenic nerve might be considered.
Wow, surgery for hiccups, that sounds extreme.
It's definitely a last resort. And just quickly, before we leave this section, it's worth distinguishing aerophagia of excessive belching, as the sources cover it separately.
Aerophagia. Literally air eating.
That's the idea. It's not just swallowing a bit of air while eating. It's the compulsive or repeated swallowing of large volumes of air. And this air doesn't really get vented effectively through belching. Instead, it goes down into the intestines and causes significant abdominal distension and bloating, sometimes quite severe. The sources specifically mention it can be a significant issue in, for instance, mentally disabled children.
And how do they diagnose that?
Well, a diagnostic clue mentioned can be seen on imaging, like x-rays. You see severely distended bowels, but notably without the air fluid levels you'd expect if there was a mechanical blockage.
Ah, interesting difference.
Yeah, and it's treated differently than behavioral belching, sometimes requiring specific medications to help reduce gas or manage motility, or even temporary tube insertion to relieve really acute distension.
So to wrap up this first part then, these everyday functions we totally take for granted, burping, hiccuping, and this less common aerophagia, they're governed by intricate mechanisms. They might have surprising evolutionary ties, like that fascinating hiccup hypothesis. And when they go wrong or become excessive, they can be indicators of potentially serious underlying health issues. There's a lot more science there than meets the eye. Okay, let's totally shift gears now. We're moving from inside the body to how we see the outside world. Let's talk about the other side of our sources. Reflection. At first glance, it seems utterly simple, doesn't it? Light hits a surface, bounces off, you see something. Done.
It does seem simple, but the physics behind it, especially how mirrors work, is actually quite deep. In physics, reflection is precisely defined as the change in direction of a wavefront now. That could be light, but it could also be sound. Or water waves when it hits a boundary between two different media. And that change causes it to return back into the original medium it came from. Think of an echo that's just sound reflection.
Right. And our sources really zoom in on the reflection of light, particularly off mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
And the foundational principle here is something called the law of reflection.
Exactly. This law is, well, elegant and simple, but incredibly powerful. It states that the incoming light ray, the ray that bounces off, the reflected ray, and an imaginary line drawn perpendicular to the surface right where the light hits.
That's the normal line.
That's the normal line, yes. All three of those, incident ray, reflected ray, normal line, lie in the same flat plane. And the critical part is this. The angle between the incoming ray and the normal, that's the angle of incidence, lie, is precisely equal to the angle between the reflected ray and the normal, the angle of reflection, Thor.
The equal store.
Always. The diagrams in the sources show this really clearly, this geometric relationship.
And why does light actually bounce back? Is it really just like throwing a tiny ball at a wall?
It's a bit more complex at the microscopic level than just bouncing. Classically, you can think about it like this. When light waves hit a surface, they cause the electrons in the atoms of that material to vibrate or oscillate. These vibrating electrons then re-emit light waves. For a good mirror, especially a metal one, the way these re-emitted waves combine results in the light effectively traveling back out according to that law of reflection.
So it's an interaction, not just a passive bounce.
Exactly. Quantum mechanics describes it a bit differently, involving photon probabilities and summing paths. But the observable outcome, the behavior we see, is the same. It's an active interaction between light and the material's atoms. And we see different results from reflection depending on the surface it hits. The sources distinguish two main types we encounter every single day.
Okay, like the difference between looking at yourself in a shiny mirror versus looking at, say, this piece of paper.
Precisely. A mirror gives you that clear, sharp image, that specular reflection. It happens on very smooth surfaces, mirrors, polished metal, maybe a perfectly still pond. Because the surface is smoothed down to the wavelength of light, all the incoming parallel light rays hit at essentially the same angle relative to the local normal line, so they all reflect off parallel to each other. This organized reflection is what forms clear images.
Okay, specular means smooth, parallel rays out, clear image. Got it. What's the other type?
The other type is diffuse reflection. This is what happens on rough surfaces like that, paper, fabric, wood, even water when it's choppy. The surface has microscopic bumps and irregularities. So even if the light hits the overall surface at the same angle at the microscopic level, it's hitting tiny surfaces tilted in all sorts of random directions.
Ah, so the law of reflection still applies to each tiny bump, but the bumps are pointing everywhere.
Exactly. So the light scatters off in all directions. This diffuse reflection is actually how we see most non-shiny objects around us. Light from the sun or a lamp hits them, scatters diffusely, and some of that scattered light enters our eyes. We see the object itself, but we don't see a mirror-like reflection of the light source on its surface, usually.
Okay. So seeing the object itself is diffuse reflection.
Yeah.
Seeing your reflection on the object, like on a calm lake, that's specular reflection. And that only happens on really smooth surfaces. That makes total sense.
Exactly. Now, when we focus on specular reflection from plane mirrors, just your standard flat mirrors, the images they form have some really consistent properties. They're always virtual images.
Virtual, meaning the light isn't actually there behind the mirror. It just looks like it is.
Correct. The light rays from the object spread out, hit the mirror, then reflect off and enter your eyes. Your brain traces those diverging rays backward in straight lines, and they appear to originate from a point located behind the mirror. But no light actually goes back there. The image is just an optical illusion of where the light seems to have come from. The image in a plane mirror is also upright, so not upside down. It's the same size as the object, and critically, it appears to be located exactly the same distance behind the mirror as the real object is in front of it.
Object distance equals image distance. And the classic left-right reversal, like how an ambulance has backwards lettering so you can read it in your rearview mirror.
Yes, that's part of it too. The image is effectively flowed along the axis perpendicular to the mirror surface. We typically perceive this as a left-to-right reversal. The sources show how basic geometry, just using similar triangles and the law of reflection, proves that object distance equals image distance.
There's a really surprising practical example mentioned in the sources about how much mirror you actually need to see your full self. Blew my mind a little.
Oh, that one is a great everyday wonder. It seems totally counterintuitive, but to see your entire height in a plane mirror, you only need a mirror that is exactly half your height.
Half? Not the full height. How does that work? Does it matter how far away you stand?
Nope. Your distance doesn't matter. It comes directly from the law of reflection, that fair thing again. To see the very top of your head, light travels from your head, hits the mirror at a certain point, and reflects down to your eyes. Because of the equal angles, that point on the mirror it needs to hit is exactly halfway vertically between the top of your head and your eyes.
Okay.
Similarly, to see your feet, light travels from your feet, hits the mirror lower down, and reflects up to your eyes. Again, due to the angles, that reflection point is exactly halfway vertically between your feet and your eyes. So the only part of the mirror you actually use to see your full reflection is the section between those two points, the top of head reflection point and the feet reflection point. And that vertical distance on the mirror turns out to be exactly half your total height.
That is genuinely wild. I am definitely going to go measure my bathroom mirror after this.
Give it a try. The sources also briefly touch on multiple reflections, like if you put two mirrors at a 90-degree angle, you see three images. Or if you put two mirrors facing each other, you get that illusion of infinite images receding into the distance, although real-world imperfections always limit that effect.
Right. The Hall of Mirrors effect. Okay, so that's flat mirrors. What about the spherical mirrors, the curved ones?
Spherical mirrors are basically sections cut from a sphere. If the inner caved inside is reflective, it curves inward towards you. That's a concave mirror. Think of the inside of a spoon. If the outer bulging side is reflective, it curves outward. That's a convex mirror, like the back of the spoon.
Okay, concave caves in, convex bulges out.
Right.
And the law of reflection still applies at every single point on the curved surface, but now the normal line, the perpendicular line, is different for each point. It always points towards or away from the center of the original sphere that the mirror was part of. That's called the center of curvature, C. These mirrors also have a principal axis, a line through the center, a focal point, F, and a focal length, F, which is the distance from the mirror to the focal point. For a concave mirror, parallel light rays hitting near the center, we call them paraxial rays, all converge, they meet. at a single point in front of the mirror. That point is the focal point, F. Its focal length, F, is considered positive, and for a perfect spherical mirror with paraxial rays, F is half the radius of curvature, F equals R2. Rays hitting farther from the center don't focus perfectly, which causes a blurring called spherical aberration.
And convex mirrors, do they focus light too? Convex mirrors do the opposite. Parallel rays hitting a convex mirror bounce off and spread out, they diverge. But they appear to diverge from a single point located behind the mirror. That's the focal point for a convex mirror, and its focal length is considered negative.
Okay, so concave converges light to a real point in front. Convex makes light seem to diverge from a virtual point behind.
Mm-hmm.
And the images you get from these curved mirrors are much more varied than with flat ones, right? Not always the same size or upright.
Absolutely. Using ray tracing diagrams, which the sources explain conceptually drawing specific rays, like one parallel to the axis, one through the focal point, one through the center of curvature, or using the mirror equation, you can figure out where the images form and what they look like. With a concave mirror, what you see depends heavily on how far the object is from the mirror. If the object is far away, beyond the center of curvature, you typically get a smaller, upside-down, real image.
Real meaning the light rays actually converge there. You could put a screen there and see the image.
Exactly. You could project it. As you move the object closer, say between the center of curvature, C, and the focal point, F, the real image gets larger, but it's still inverted. But then, if you move the object really close, closer than the focal point between F and the mirror surface, something different happens. The reflected rays diverge, they don't meet. So your brain traces them backward behind the mirror, and you see a larger, upright, virtual image. That's the principle behind magnifying makeup mirrors or shaving mirrors.
So concave mirrors can make things look smaller and inverted, or bigger and upright, depending on where you put the object. What about convex?
Convex mirrors are much simpler in that regard. They always form a virtual, upright, and reduced smaller image, no matter how far away the object is.
Always smaller and upright.
Always smaller and upright and virtual behind the mirror. Because they make everything look smaller, they effectively compress a wider field of view into the mirror's surface area. That's why they're used as those side view mirrors on cars, the ones that often say objects in mirror are closer than they appear, and also as security mirrors in shops to see large areas.
Okay, that makes sense. The sources also provide the mathematical tools for this.
That's right. Yeah.
The mirror equation and the magnification equation.
Right. They're there for quantitative prediction. The mirror equation is 1 grado plus 1 di equals 1 f, where du is object distance, di is image distance, and f is focal length. It lets you calculate exactly where the image will form. And the magnification equation is m equal s d do, which also equals hi ho, image height over object height. This tells you how much bigger or smaller the image is and whether it's upright or inverted based on the sign.
The signs are important then, right?
Crucial. The sign conventions tell you if distances are in front, usually positive, or behind, usually negative, if focal lengths are converging positive or diverging negative, and if images are real, positive di, or virtual negative di, upright positive m, or inverted negative m. The examples in the source material walk through using these equations for specific scenarios.
And reflection isn't confined to just visible light, as the sources Brueckli note near the end.
That's true. The same fundamental principles of waves bouncing off boundaries apply elsewhere. Sound reflection is huge in acoustics and sonar, echolocation. Seismic reflection is used in geology to map structures deep underground by bouncing sound waves off rock layers. And the sources even mention more complex, even speculative ideas like time reflections in certain wave physics contexts.
So, to sum up this segment, the seemingly simple act of reflection, which literally lets us see our surroundings and ourselves, is governed by fundamental physics. From how light interacts with matter at the atomic level to elegant geometric rules about angles and curves, it leads to different outcomes: clear images from smooth surfaces, scattered light from rough ones, magnification, or wider views from curved mirrors. And it has surprising practical consequences, like needing only half your height in a mirror or understanding why objects in that car mirror really are closer than they appear. Wow. Okay, we've covered a lot of ground today. We've journeyed from the hidden, intricate science happening inside our own bodies with something as seemingly mundane as a burp or a hiccup, all the way to the fundamental physics of light that shapes how we perceive the external world and see ourselves in a mirror. It's quite a contrast.
It truly underscores how looking closely at even the most ordinary parts of our existence, whether internal bodily functions or everyday optics, can reveal these deep layers of scientific detail, complex mechanisms. And sometimes, like with the hiccups, fascinating, perhaps still unanswered, evolutionary questions.
It really does change your perspective, doesn't it? They
Yes.
thank you for bringing us these sources and guiding us through this deep dive into these, well, ordinary yet truly extraordinary topics.
And we hope it inspires you, the listener, to look at the world around you and perhaps even listen to those internal rumblings and pops with a renewed sense of wonder and curiosity about the science hidden in plain sight.
Absolutely. So what does this all mean for how we perceive the ordinary? Maybe consider next time you glance in a mirror that the seemingly simple act of seeing your reflection isn't just light passively bouncing off. It's a dynamic interaction between light and matter, governed by elegant physical laws, dictating precisely how that image forms in your perception.
Or perhaps the next time you get an annoying case of the hiccups, you might just think about that compelling hypothesis that it could be a faint echo of an ancient essential reflex, a biological signal connecting you across vast evolutionary time to tiny mammals just trying to make room for their next meal.
The ordinary, it turns out, is anything but. That's all for this deep dive. Bring us your sources for the next one.